Welcome to Worthless Rags and Dirty Dirty Smear Merchants, a segment where I'm going to be going over a roundup of weird, wonderful and wacky recent news. Is this segment just This Week in Stupid with a different title because I didn't want to call it This Week in Stupid? Keep watching to find out. So the first thing that I wanted to cover was something that was neither from a worthless rag nor written by a dirty, dirty smear merchant, because I wanted to go over some news that's been going on in the entertainment industry, that being that Disney have replaced, well, they fired their current CEO, Bob Chapek, and replaced him with the man who he replaced, Bob Iger. And I saw a lot of people on the right saying that Bob Chapek's left because he was trying to push the woke agenda. Therefore, this means that Disney's coming back around, yada, yada. No, it's not. Bob Iger, don't get your hopes up. Bob Iger is the guy who implemented all of this woke nonsense in the first place. And it's not going to change. In fact, it'll probably get worse because Chapek came in, said he wanted to remove some of the wokeness and focus on making entertaining content. I know. Shocking that an entertainment business would want to do that, and then immediately got harassed by his own staff, turned back around on it, told Ron DeSantis that he wasn't going to support the Don't Say Gay bill or the parental rights bill, and then Ron DeSantis hit back by taking away Disneyland's self-governance status. So he had a very bad initial run, and now it seems to top all of that off. Less than a year into him being CEO, he's been kicked off again. And there are some insider ideas as to why this happened from a person who's a Disney insider known as WDW Pro, who appeared on a podcast called Midnight's Edge and speculated as to the cause of Chapek's firing. He stated, "When we see a change like this, it tends to come from the institutional level. This doesn't happen. This doesn't come from anything that's very small. So what I think probably happened is Bob Chapek, he's got some enemies, and those enemies were primarily coming out of Latondra Newton's department over in HR. With the DEI stuff, and that's highly connected with ESG. So the threat seemed to have been, if we don't go ahead with the woke stuff, massive investors like BlackRock and Vanguard are going to pull out." He said it's not like just some part-time investor who's got some money saved who's going to pull out his 10 grand stock. It's going to be the massive companies who have invested millions and millions of dollars that will absolutely tank the stock prices. Who are going to be pulling out, which is why they've gone into damage mode and removed Chapek and put Iger back in instead. So it's kind of like they got swapped out someone who gave the slightest pushback for someone establishment and business as usual. It's like Trust to Sunak in miniature in Disney.
It's a good analogy, yeah.
Yes. And another interesting bit of news coming from the Disney camp was that a Marvel studio producer said that he considered it a red flag if prospective writers are fans of the original comics, and he prefers to hire someone who's out of the culture. Now, when you're dealing with levels of autism known within comic book fans and their attention to detail, and I mean, you've met Connor, and what they like
very
to
nice.
What they like to see, I like comic books as well. What they like to see is what they've read on the page. Do you think it's a great business decision to spit in their faces and say, we're going to hire somebody who doesn't know anything about the comic books, who likely hates them and will not represent what you love about the character on screen?
Well, if you carry out a faithful adaptation, these diehard fans are going to carry a lot of water for you. They're going to be spreading the word about your amazing product. It's basically like free PR. So you want these people on side because it's good for business.
And that's what got Zack Snyder's cut of the Justice League. What allowed that to exist was the fan backlash at Joss Whedon's version, and fans were the ones who really pushed Snyder's vision up, which eventually forced Warner Brothers to release that edited version of it. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of it, but that just shows how the support from these people can be very beneficial for you, and like you said, act as free marketing. So the man was Nate Moore, who was a producer who appeared on a podcast with the host Matthew Belloni. Or Bellany, I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce that. He said, "I don't want you to have an already pre-existing idea of what the comic is because you grew up with the comics and that's what you want to recreate. I want someone who's going to be hard on the material, who can go, what is this? I think there's a movie here, but maybe we should be looking at it this way." And as far as I'm concerned, this is like saying, "I want to hire a plumber, but I don't want anyone who's ever seen a pipe before. I need a new and inventive way of looking at plumbing." And if you're taking this as a job, to create something entertaining that's going to make you money, this is a very bad way of going about it. But that's why we end up with absolute trash like Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, which, once again, I watched with Connor recently, and we've got a review of it on the website. If you're a premium subscriber, you can check that out. There are also clips on the YouTube channel, lotuseaters.com, if you want to see a little preview of what we talked about there. Let's move on to some more strictly politically material, though, where we find that we've got journalists asking important questions and really taking putting the feet of power to the fire, really speaking truth to them. Like to this article from The Conversation asking about Elon Musk's hardcore management style and saying that it's a case study in what not to do. In your segment that we covered, Elon Musk seemed to actually be doing a pretty good job.
Yes.
Do you think they're going to mention anything to do with him removing all of the child pornography?
I don't think so. If anything, that's going to work against his favour in their view.
I know, right? Once again, I wonder who the main consumers of that were. But their point seems to be here that Elon Musk came in, fired a lot of people, which was a very, very mean thing to do. And everything else that he's done, he's reinstated mean people on the website. Therefore, he's doing a bad job managing it.
What does the world's richest man know about business? I mean,
I know. Absolutely terrifying. And then they say, since taking over Twitter on October 27th, Musk stopped employees working from home, cancelled their lunches, and laid off about 3,700 employees, roughly half of their workforce. Many realised they'd been sacked when they could no longer access their laptops. Just days later, it emerged that Musk had a team of snoopers comb through employees' private messages on Slack, firing those who criticised him, which sounds incredibly based. Then, on Wednesday last week, Musk sent an ultimatum to staff to pledge commitment to a new, extremely hardcore Twitter that will mean working hours at long hours at high intensity. Employees had until 5 the next day to accept or take a severance package, and apparently 500 staff reportedly wrote farewell messages. And you know what? Nothing of any value was lost. If you're going to try and make me feel bad for the kind of Silicon Valley tech executives who have been in charge of strangling the public conversation for the past 5 years, tough luck.
I mean, it's a successful app. If you can't make it profitable,
which they
must
weren't.
Be mismanaging it.
I know. There are some, like I say, this is basically just listing his successes. Mm-hmm. This is a victory lap. I'm sure if you read all of this information to Elon Musk, he'd just have a big grin on his face and then post a little cheeky tweet about it. The rest of the article does talk about some issues and problems with his management style and his attempts to walk a little bit of that back. But most of this article is in the tone of an aggravated and jilted ex. So I don't really know how much I trust the rest of the information other than listing the bad things that he's done, which I'm fully in support of. Speaking of bad things happening to bad people. This was an amusing thing that I spotted recently, which was the Amazing Atheist, who, yes, is an atheist, but is by no means amazing, sending this message on his Facebook or a YouTube comment by the looks of it, saying that within 12 hours of my Twitter account being restored from a 7-day suspension, the account has been permanently banned from Elon Musk's free speech platform. Musk's Twitter is nothing more than a right-wing hug box where conservatives are free to say anything and leftists are gaffled up, don't think that's a word, it must be a typo, for pushing back. I will be looking for an alternative platform where I can express myself more freely without constant fear of censorship. It's pathetic that it has come to this and that a social media site that I used to enjoy despite its toxicity has turned into such a one-sided, despotic garbage heap. It's not nice when the shoe's on the other foot, is it? Lots of leftists complaining that what used to be our one-sided despotic garbage heap is now the right wing's. And I don't even think that it is, because Elon's just trying to be a bit more fair and even-handed about the whole thing. And I think Prudentialist sums this up quite well with his little caption here. Womp, womp. That's all you really need to say onto it.
And also, it's worth mentioning that he's not representative of atheists. He's a bit insufferable.
He is massively
in the same way that the Westboro Baptist Church isn't representative of Christians. He's not representative of me, all right?
I'd say he's representative of a lot of leftist atheists, though.
Yeah, the condescending types.
Yes, the type who turn it into a culture battle whenever they're around anybody religious, and they need to let you know that you're an idiot if you have any sort of religious feeling.
What, you said you'd pray for me? What are you, stupid? How dare you give me that nice gesture?
I know, it's insufferable. And speaking of lol cows like the Amazing Atheist, we've got Salon with this article, Wake Up Mainstream Media, Donald Trump's Comeback is Not Funny. There you go.
I can't not laugh.
It is, actually. The man is the most dangerous political figure in recent history. Stop making fun of him and tell the truth. So Salon seems to have moved past the Putin is the new Hitler and gone straight back to TDS. It's brilliant. I love how these figures can just be switched interchangeably by these people. Trump literally attempted a violent coup and has clearly proven himself to be a fascist, a white supremacist, and corrupt demagogue. He has no sense of the public good and through willful negligence and depraved indifference was culpable for the deaths of countless people in the United States during the COVID pandemic. He's the leader of a neo-fascist movement that's repeatedly demonstrated its propensity for violence and contempt for democracy. And I'm sorry, whoever wrote this, he's not, I don't think he's interested, mate. He's not going to sleep with you. No matter how much you cry, no matter how much you wail, he's not going to pay any attention to this because this, as much as you wish it wasn't, is hilarious. This is why I'm glad that Trump is back, even if he's only just on Twitter still and not posting anything, even if his campaign for 2024 goes nowhere. Who cares? Because we get this beautiful, delicious screeching.
The slugs and snails of the world cower at the amount of salt this man can produce.
No, it's going to be genocide. And speaking of journalists who are experiencing a lot of trauma at the moment, like everyone is, there was this amazing USA Today tweet with a quote from an article they wrote called, where it says, "Journalists carry trauma on our souls," according to the editor-in-chief, Nicole Carroll. Our industry, of course, is not the only one. Healthcare workers, educators, first responders and many others face new pressures, but we just want you to know that we as journalists are right up there with them. Those on the front lines, those first responders there jumping into fire, literally to save people's lives. Journalists, we're just like, James O'Brien approves this message.
I can't believe how openly they're just patting themselves on the back, just like, we're basically heroes.
It's sickening, isn't it? These people literally think that they're troopers on the front lines of the culture war, and they literally think that, I mean, they say it all the time, so it's no surprise, but it's interesting when they put it like this, because it really goes to show just how deeply embedded it is. They literally think that we're Nazis, because they literally think that even engaging with us causes them the same level of trauma as a first responder.
Not to sound too much like a leftist, which is not something I want to preface what I say, but we're pretty much journalists, right? But I feel very privileged. I don't feel like it's a trauma to be a journalist.
No.
I feel very fortunate.
We often have to engage with some pretty dark subject matter and really depressing material. But at the end of the day, I get to spend my time day to day engaged with subjects I'm interested in. I get to speak to people that are really interesting and that I learn a lot from, and I get the opportunity to do a lot of things that I never would have been able to in any other job.
Exactly.
So it's not like I can really complain too much about my position right now.
The notion of journalists carry trauma on our souls. I mean, get over yourselves, for goodness sake.
Yeah, absolutely. And then more hilarious journalism from Jezebel with this article talking about how the author will die alone before ever opening this anti-woke dating app. Sad to say that that means it's working because they don't want you on there. Just when you thought we had enough conservative blondes to spread the gospel of conspiracy theorists, Kaylee McEnany-Light enters from the stage right. Ryan McEnany, thank you. The sister of Donald Trump's former White House press secretary has merged from Republicans for up-and-coming Fox News anchors to convince her peers to download a new conservative-only dating app called The Right Stuff. And who better to persuade Republican men to whip out their wallets, dicks, and ballots than a conventionally attractive white woman who tweets anti-trans dog whistles in her spare time? I mean, I'm sold. That sounds like the ideal woman. Oh no, not a conventionally attractive blonde. Oh no, what am I going to do? Oh dear. I mean, seriously though, I do find the whole idea of like a right-wing dating app a little bit weird. I don't know if that really gels with a right-wing view of society, because I understand it's really not practical for a lot of people, but if you can, I would always recommend trying to go out and meeting people face to face.
I think the data seems to show that if you meet someone in your real life, it's far more likely to work than if you've used a dating app. So that's one of the main flaws of the dating app, is that even if you find someone that you get along with and seem to be compatible with, it probably is not going to last by merit of the fact that they've got access to, in their pocket, pretty much everyone who uses a dating app.
Yes, although a lot of the dating apps, I've never used one, thankfully, I've never had to, but I know that some people who, we've spoken to who have tried to use them have just said it's just a hell. It's a hellhole. Every single person on them has pronouns in the bio. They all have BLM flags and all that sort of stuff. So I can understand the appeal of doing this.
I have seen that before.
Yeah,
but it's quite funny. But and in Britain, lots of them have orange faces and horrific clown makeup.
They are hideous people. So I completely understand the appeal of having a dating app where you're able to avoid that stuff. But once again, if you can, try and meet people in real life if it's practical and available to you. But speaking of leftist dating, though, I found this hilarious Guardian headline under sexual healing and life and style. My wife and I haven't had sex for 15 years. I haven't even seen her naked. Is it time for us to break up?
No, that's the perfect marriage.
I don't think it's working out, but, you know, as long as you're still getting meals every day, that's enough for Josh. If she's cooking dinner, that's all you need. And it's not like these people have never had sex, or he's never seen her naked, which kind of is what the headline implies. It's that he had an affair 25 years ago, and he says, it was wonderful to feel loved and lusted after, but for now, for the sake of the kids, it stopped. I got on with my career and provided for my family. Now I'm in my 60s and desperate. I just want to feel loved and have a tactile relationship. I know this sounds pathetic, but I feel damaged by all of this because I am desperately lonely and angry.
Well, that's just the consequences of your own decisions, isn't it?
You've dug this grave for yourself, mate. I mean, you're the one who had an affair. Maybe your wife would have been much happier and maybe more willing to sleep with you if you hadn't cheated on her. This is a suggestion for all men out there. If you're in a dedicated and loving relationship, especially if you have children, don't cheat. I know. Shocking.
I've never heard such advice before.
I know. And on to more embarrassing love stories. Keir Starmer revealed that he has, in fact, in the past kissed a Tory, and he is not ashamed.
Did he like it, in fact?
He did. He kissed a Tory and he liked it. And
why are we referencing pop music?
I don't know who to feel sorry for in this situation.
Whoever has to read this.
I would neither feel sorry... I would both feel sorry for Keir Starmer for having to kiss a Tory, and feel sorry for the Tory for having to kiss Keir Starmer. So this
everyone
is
loses.
Yeah, everyone's lost in this one. The Labour leader said he's not tribal and has broken the never kiss a Tory rule, because this is a really cringe thing that a lot of people in the English left do, is they wear little badges that say never kiss the Tory, and it's like, well, good, I wouldn't want to kiss you anyway. Not that I am a Tory. But he also says he has many Conservative friends. And interestingly enough, off the back of that, it seems that perhaps the Conservative friends of, how do I phrase this without it sounding dirty, have been having an effect on Keir, because he recently made a speech which shocked all of us, I think, by sounding, I know this isn't, he's not sounding like Nigel Farage or anything like that, but he's actually sounding like he's got more of a principled stance on immigration than the Conservatives do at the moment, when he stated that Britain's immigration dependency needs to end. So this was a speech he gave at a CBI conference, which is the Confederation of British Industries, and he called for businesses to focus on investing more in training up workers who are already here. My God, what a far-right bigot this man must be. He warned bosses that the days when low pay and cheap labour are part of the British way on growth must end. But he insisted we would also have to be pragmatic on skills and labour shortages felt by firms, and he would improve on the existing points-based immigration system that was brought in after Brexit. And as far as I know, I don't even know what we've done with this points-based immigration system. It's certainly not reduced immigration numbers.
The numbers are higher than ever, aren't they?
Yes, they are. So the standards on these points must be very, very low indeed. So any improvement would be best. And this is not an endorsement for Labour or Keir Starmer himself. This is just saying that it's shocking that Keir Starmer is able to put forward a stronger sounding idea of what should happen with British immigration than the Tories should. And he actually seems to care, in the speech at least, more about local workers than the Tories do.
Well, that's unsurprising for Labour. I mean, talking about workers is their bread and butter, isn't it?
I know. And yet all of this has reminded me of certain feelings that I have, which are shared by this man, who says that Earth now has 8 billion humans, and this man wishes that there were none. And Josh still doesn't think it goes far enough. You're leaving any life on Earth at all, and Josh is way too far gone.
Just because I'm an evil scientist doesn't mean I want to destroy all life on Earth. That's too unambitious. All life in the universe, please.
As you would expect from a headline like this, it's a eco-warrior mindset coming from this. For the sake of the planet, Les Knight, the founder of the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, I'll read that again, the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, which later in the article, it explicitly states he had to add the word voluntary to the beginning of it because people got the idea that he just wanted to murder people. He's like, no, we just want to die out peacefully. I'm not calling for like genocide of the human race or anything.
I mean, at least stand by your hard aligned stance, for goodness sake.
Yeah, he spent decades pushing one message, may we live long and die out. I don't remember
that
episode.
Live long and prosper.
I don't remember that episode of Star Trek, no. And this is an excellent point to remind everybody that Carl and I did a book club on the esoteric views of what are called the antinatalists, who are people who want the human race to die out for the benefit of the planet. They want it to be just here for animal and wildlife, obviously ignoring the fact that presumably evolution would cause something like humans to spring up again. Even if given enough time on a long enough timeline, it's going to happen. Even
if we abandon a niche in the ecosystem, something else is going to come and take our place.
Yes, but there was an excellent roundup of this in this book, The A Human Manifesto, by gothic nutcase Patricia McCormack, who's eager to let you know that she works as a university professor at a university associated with Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
It's Ruskin,
Anglia Ruskin, is, I believe, one of the lowest ranking universities in the country.
Yes, but it's associated kind of with Cambridge, so she wants to really emphasise that matter. But that's an absolutely mental book where she talks about things like compassionate suicide. Basically, if you've watched True Detective, what Rust says near the beginning of that, of just wanting all of humanity to hold hands and walk into the ocean together and drown.
I did think of that when you were talking about this.
Yes, that's the message that's being put forward by this book. So that's all I've got for today, folks. Thank you very much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
If you appreciated that segment from the podcast of the Lotus Eaters, you can go to lotuseaters.com to get access to all the premium content we have on the site, such as the premium hangouts we do, this one on Biden's AI Bill of Rights. If you'd like to find out what else we're putting out, you can follow us on Getter at lotuseaters_com on Getter. Thank you and goodbye.